From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Chris Swanson is the president of Gutenberg College in Eugene. Thank you so much for coming on to the Oregon Grapevine, Chris. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Let's just start with a brief overview of what is Gutenberg College. I think it probably people don't know what there's another college in Eugene. What is it and how does it work?
Sure. Gutenberg College is a four-year liberal arts college. You get a degree, a Bachelor of Arts in Liberal Arts. We are distinctive in that our curriculum is a single curriculum. There are no other majors. All the students take the same course of study. They're with each other every day in all their classes together. If you start as a freshman, you stay with your freshman class, you're with them for 4 years. We are also distinctive in that it is a sort of a discussion-based school, so we're interested in reading books that were influential in our culture, influential in history, things that have sort of set the stage for where we are right here in the world today, and we read those books and discuss them. So heavily discussion-oriented. It is modeled after a school called St. John's, if anybody knows what St. John's College is. So that gives you sort of a basic framework. We're also a Christian college, and we have a very residential familial atmosphere. It's an extremely small college. We have about 17 students all told, and we all get to know each other. We spend a lot of time with each other. We get to know each other's ins and outs, but also it provides the opportunity for students to really think and interact with each other and ask questions that they want to ask. So
I'm going to bounce around, but one thing that kind of pops into my head is I had a conversation at one point with a philosophy professor, and I know some parents who were going, why the heck would my child want to be a philosophy major? So what someone says, Mom, I want to go to Gutenberg College. How does that kind of go over? What does Mom say? What are you going to do with that degree? How does that work? How do you convince someone that really, or maybe you don't need to convince them, why are the people and the students drawn to this very kind of esoteric way of spending your college life?
That's a great question. Well, I like to say that everybody is a philosopher. It's just not very many people think very carefully about the philosophy that they have. And the opportunity at Gutenberg College is for students to actually think about what they believe and why they believe it and where did those ideas come from. And should I ascribe to those particular beliefs? We live in a world where there are a lot of beliefs, and our culture is very powerful, and a lot of times we believe the things from the people that we live around, our culture, our subculture, our friends, our family, that sort of thing like that. And Gutenberg College is an opportunity for people to really think and grapple with those sorts of questions. And there are people that are interested in grappling with, who am I? What am I about here in the world? Why am I supposed to do these sorts of things? So, I mean, that just sort of gives you the tip of the iceberg, but there are a lot of other reasons that people might want to come to Gutenberg College as well, and we can explore some of those. I mean, it's much more of a personal, relational kind of institution. It is also a Christian institution, and a lot of students are interested in pursuing, thinking about who they are with respect to God, and we give them an opportunity to ask those questions as well. And we actually give them a freedom to pursue those questions sort of without very many boundaries, which is kind of scary, I think, for a lot of students and parents and us as well. So
when you talk about biblically based teaching, and there is in this world different interpretations of what that means. So how does that work? Is it a specific, this is the Bible, this is one of the books we're reading, this is one of the founding philosophies of our life, and this is what it means? How do you kind of open up the door to different ways of interpreting that document and the theology around it?
That's a fantastic question, Barbara. Thank you. Well, we have a, I guess, a founding belief at Gutenberg College, something that all the faculty subscribe to, and that is a philosophy of reading, which sounds like a strange place to start, but it is key. And our philosophy of reading is that we are attempting to understand any book, whether it be the Bible or a literary work or some other philosophical or historical document. We're trying to understand it from the perspective of the author. What was it that they were trying to communicate to the culture that they lived in? That requires sometimes a little bit of understanding of the culture that they lived in, which is why we tend to have most of our classes in a sequence that goes through history. But it also requires a lot of skill of interpretation to try and understand the nuance of what is being said, the context of what is being said, trying to pull those sorts of things out. Now, I recognize that the Bible is one of the most difficult books in the world to interpret. And we are willing to recognize that there are a lot of different approaches or a lot of different conclusions that people draw from that. And we are willing to dialogue with anybody who is wanting to propose their own particular perspective and ask questions about their particular perspectives. And a lot of students come from different perspectives about the Bible. And we are absolutely willing and interested in dialoguing with the with them about those perspectives. We're not afraid of those perspectives. So our biggest thrust will be, so tell me how you're getting that conclusion from the text that we are all reading together here. And, you know, we've had a little bit more experience perhaps than the students, but we are recognizing that we could be making a mistake as well. So we're not trying to profess a particular perspective. That's not to say we don't have a perspective, but we're trying not to profess it. I think part of the reason that Gutenberg College teachers are called tutors as opposed to professors is because we see ourselves as walking alongside the students, trying to figure out what is it that the authors that we are reading are saying. We really do feel like the authors of the books that we're reading are really the primary teachers, and we are the secondary teachers. We are there to help them uncover what they can get from the books that they are reading. And the Bible, obviously, is one of the most important books, and we read that fairly substantially in the curriculum. But again, with this same approach to reading, a free inquiry, them willing to ask their own questions, make their own conclusions, we're not going to force them to take our particular perspective, and many don't.
I know there's a word or a title called great books. I don't necessarily know what it sounds finite to me. My impression is that it's finite. I don't know that. There's certain books that are thrown into it that people talk about, but they end at a certain time. Is there a historically end date for when, okay, we're only going to read these books that go up to 1950 or to 1820 or whatever? How do you decide, are there books that are currently written books that you are reading, or how does that curriculum chosen?
It's very difficult. The term great books, I think, I may be mistaken, but I think it comes from a series of books that were put out in the 40s. I think that was the time by Mortimer Adler and Robert Hutchins, called The Great Books of the Western World. And those were sold widely throughout the United States. And their goal, and ours too, to some extent, was to look at those works that have been most influential in the history of ideas. And so choosing which books are the most influential is a tricky chore. Generally, people look at how much they were read, how much they were impacted the future thinkers and stuff, how much they have had an impact on the culture that we live in today. So obviously somebody like Aristotle was hugely influenced all through the medieval and Renaissance period, even up to today. So we're going to read him, right? Now, there are going to be a lot of differences of opinion, and we spend time as a faculty all the time looking at our particular selection of books and say, well, should we keep that one or toss that one? How did the discussion go in that one? Is that one really significant? Are we missing something? So we are in that conversation trying to make those decisions, and we may or may not make the right decisions, but they're the decisions that we're making. And when it comes to the more modern period, it's much harder. Because one of the things that you can look at for ancient books is how have they stood the test of time. Whereas after about the 1950s or the 1980s, have they stood the test of time is a harder question to answer, because they may be popular for a period of time and then go out of fashion or no longer be read. So we have to be a little bit more careful. We don't read a lot of books after the 1960s or 70s. We don't tend to spend a lot of time. We do have one course that we introduced more recently that gives the students an opportunity to take on what we call a contemporary issue. So we gave the students an option to say, what contemporary issue that is out there would you like to pursue? And then we would pick that topic, and we would look at it historically and some of the developing ideas that came from it. And we would read current works and things that are very contemporary on that issue, because the issue is so contemporary. The last one that the students wanted to pursue was the nature of gender and sexuality. So that's the one that we picked, and we spent a whole quarter reading some of the seminal works in that area.
You mentioned that students enter, they're with a class, and they keep going. Is there also, like, for particularly the class you just mentioned, for instance, did the seniors do that class, or did everybody do that class? And if the seniors did that class and the freshmen decided they also wanted to do that, how do you make that determination? Is there kind of cross-pollinization that way?
Sure. Well, because we're a small college, we do have to make some choices in terms of staffing ability and that sort of thing. So it turns out that the juniors and seniors take a course together. It's called Great Conversation in their last 2 years. And they are always together. So, and it covers a 2-year period or a 2-year course of study. And so the juniors and seniors will be together in one year, and then next year the juniors will become seniors, and they will be joined with the previous class and so on. So it swaps back and forth. So that particular class, the contemporary issues class that I mentioned, is something that both the juniors and seniors take together, and it's offered every other year so that everybody has a chance to take it. And we may change that to a particular topic as times go forward if the students are interested in something else.
In this school, I know that you don't just sit and read, although reading is clearly one of the things you do and discuss. I think there's a community involvement part of the curriculum that you do. And certainly as you look at people who are people of faith, many of the people of faith believe that it's not just an intellectual exercise, it's actually a life calling. So how do you put that piece into what you're teaching and demonstrating to your students? And faculty, for that matter.
Sure, sure. Gutenberg is definitely kind of a close community in and of itself because of the size. It is housed in a building on the corner of 19th and University Street, which is an old fraternity building. And so we are fortunate to have that building. And in the second floor, we have a number of residential rooms. So we can house up to 20 students at a time in the building. And many of our students live there. They're not required to live there. They are free to go and find other housing if they want. We are not strong on coercing people to do anything. but many students do live in that community. They get five dinners a week cooked for them, and then they're responsible for their other meals. So that creates, in some sense, a kind of a communal life for the students. And the faculty are around a lot, and we participate. Sometimes we come for dinners, or we'll have events where the students and the faculty will get together. We have Friday tea every week after our last class. We all get together. Somebody brings a treat to share, and we all drink tea and hang out and spend time. So I'm having students over to my house for dessert and a movie, you know, once a quarter or something like that. So it's kind of one of those things where we all have opportunities to interact with students. We go out for coffee one-on-one with them. So there is definitely a communal aspect to it, and it's been really important for the development of the college. We found that the things that they are learning in class, which are academic and esoteric, do sometimes spill out into their everyday life. They're talking about something in class, and then they pursue that conversation afterwards, or they start thinking about how they're behaving towards each other, or interacting, and start rethinking who am I and what am I supposed to do here, and how am I supposed to interact with this guy who's really annoying me, for instance.
How about the conversation of comparative religions? Do you bring in other conversations? I mean, clearly the people who are there probably are Christians, and that's what they're learning and wanting to study and how that works for their lives. But do you also bring in either guest speakers or other books or other conversations about other options for spirituality?
Well, the primary focus that we have at Gutenberg College is on the Western intellectual tradition, because we live in the West, and our intellectual tradition, our world, has been framed by the Western intellectual tradition. So that's the focus of what it is that we do. Now, in that Western intellectual tradition, there is a wide variety of different religious perspectives, different religious ideas. Obviously, we start early. We see the polytheism of the time. We see a variety of other religious expressions in Rome, Stoicism, and various other kinds of philosophies that are sort of religious. There are a number of different kinds of religious, I'm not exactly sure, particular ideas within Christianity that are very, very different, that go in all kinds of different directions. There's a number of people that were dealing with religion that come after or in sort of the post-Christian world, criticizing Christianity, thinking about whether or not it's true. We read Darwin, we read Nietzsche, we read all the people that have criticisms of Christianity as well. We look at historical events, obviously the importance of the Muslim community in the history of the West was also significant. So we sort of touch on all of those things. We don't spend a lot of time pursuing, for instance, the Eastern intellectual tradition, which includes a lot of the Eastern thinking of Buddhism and Confucianism and the Indian religion and various things like that. So we do tend to focus on the West, but there's a pretty broad range of ideas on the West that sort of covers the whole gamut of what we're thinking.
How did you come to Gutenberg?
Wow. So I graduated from Christian liberal arts college in California and came up to the University of Oregon to pursue PhD studies in physics. And while I was here, I ran across an organization, sort of the forerunner of Gutenberg College, which was called Mackenzie Study Center. And it was in existence to sort of provide some sort of foundation for people who were interested in thinking about Christianity in the context of either their university studies or as community members. And so I became interested in what they were talking about and thinking about. Encouraging to me, and so I became participant in that community, and it was from that community that Gutenberg College was founded. The former president of Gutenberg College was David Crabtree, and he became interested in thinking about education. He was interested in finding a way to help people to become better readers. He wanted them to be better readers of the Bible, ultimately, but he was thinking about the kind of education that would be very helpful for students, and he started thinking about this great books model that he sees in St. John's College, and so he started a small group, a reading group, actually. It lasted about 3 years, and it was an evening class that happened once a month, and he titled it Ignoramus is Anonymous. And I knew I had to be in that class because I was a physicist and I was definitely an ignoramus and I wanted to learn. So that's where that came from. And so I was there at the beginning teaching classes when it started up. So that's kind of how I got involved.
This is backtracking a little, but this is a very kind of arcane and specialized school. And we hear a lot about just the trauma and turmoil of higher education and education in general, and how things are, why do they matter and do they matter, and et cetera, et cetera. What is it thriving, this model, not just Gutenberg, but I'm assuming you have conversations with other, at least smaller, maybe esoteric schools, whether they're specifically biblically related or not. And how do those conversations go in terms of feeling that it's thriving and important and has a future?
Boy. I would say that there has been an upsurge of interest in what I would refer to as classical K through 12 education. That is definitely thriving. There are a number of classical schools. They're opening up all over the country. Depending on the rules, there's a lot of charter schools that are growing that are also classical in nature. And so there's a lot of homeschooling that is classical in nature. And so there's a growing interest and development of interest in sort of a classical education model in K through 12. And there's societies that are helping these schools. There's a Society for Classical Learning. There's the Association for Christian Classical Schools or something like that. So there's a big movement in this area. I would say the movement in the higher education realm is not really caught up. There are a few small schools that exist around the country that are interested in the same sort of model of education that we pursue, but it is not as much in demand as sort of the K through 12. Our hope is that eventually the K through 12 upsurge of interest will fall into the higher education realm. But higher education sort of has a different way that our society thinks about it. Our society tends to think about higher education in terms of that first career move, right? So everybody is looking for, not everybody, obviously, but the majority are looking at, they want a school that has a reputation and a major that is going to give them their first step in sort of their economic life. So when they look at Gutenberg College, they look at the size of the school, they look at the strangeness of the curriculum. It's not a slam dunk for a lot of students. So it is a challenge for Gutenberg to continue to strive and thrive in the educational community that we live in right now. But we're sort of committed to it. We feel like what we have to offer here is so valuable to students. It is something that is going to impact their lives, not just their careers, but their lives for the rest of their life. And we know that our alumni are very appreciative of what they've had. We know that most of the parents are really appreciative of what their students are getting or have gotten. There's something very vibrant, life-giving, and valuable to the opportunity to come together and think about what's important. And so we're just committed to it, and we're gonna write it out and see how it goes.
Anything that we have not touched on here that you want to make sure we explain about Gutenberg before we say thank you and goodbye?
I would say one other small piece about Gutenberg College. Well, maybe a couple small pieces. One of them is sort of the financial side of things. Gutenberg College doesn't charge a lot of tuition, partly because we're small. But there's also, it goes back to sort of that relational aspect that we have with our students. When you get to know a student and you're sitting around and eating lunch with them, you know, a couple of times a week or something like that, they're a person. And so as a person, as an individual that we know, our financial dealings with them are also going to be based on sort of a personal relationship. So we strive to find a way to partner with them. So we're communicating with them and their parents, trying to figure out what is it that you are capable of paying for, and we are going to sort of fill the gap as much as it possible. We don't take federal funding, so they can't get federal loans, but we do offer our own financial aid and scholarships and things of that sort to make it possible for students to come. And I think they appreciate the fact that it's not a transaction. It's a communications partnership between us and the student. And I think that also goes with them as they graduate and they're looking for careers. We haven't talked a lot about careers, but we do provide them some services and ideas to help them think about what they want to do with their lives. So it's not just I mean, you talked about it as esoteric. I mean, it is different, for sure.
That's a better word.
It is different, but it is also, I think, the kinds of skills that they get in listening, reading, communicating, interacting, writing, those skills are very, very valuable in all works, all kinds of jobs and areas of life in the career world. And I think that as employers see somebody coming in who is willing to really listen and think about what somebody has said and interact with that in a creative way, I think that their value shows up, and employers appreciate that sort of thing too. So those were the two pieces.
Thank you. I really appreciate that insight.
Yeah.
And thank you, Chris Swanson, for coming in and talking about Gutenberg. I'm happy to learn more and appreciate the work you're doing.
Well, I'm just excited to tell other people, so thank you.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh, pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.